Hello and welcome to the Fit for Privacy podcast. In this podcast, we talk to influencers so that you learn from the best. I'm your host, Puneet Bhatia. I help business and privacy leaders to create and deliver strategies for privacy compliance and trainings. Before we start, a quick reminder that the opinions and ideas shared in this context are not legal advice. If you need advice, you should contact a professional with your specific context. So let's get started. And welcome to the Fit for Privacy podcast. And today we have a special, unique guest. Normally, we are talking to privacy influencers and those who have been in the field long. But this time, I choose to bring to you a person who has 20 plus years of law experience. So, which means there's a wealth of experience when it comes to legal matters and requirements. And he recently pivoted his career to privacy. So that's fascinating to understand, because what is the driver behind it and how is that journey and what goes behind that journey? What's the thinking process and what does he see from that perspective is what we are going to talk about. And I'm talking about Thomas Besoor. So, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon and thank you for having me.
Okay, it's great to have you, but let me ask you a question. What prompted you to pivot from your legal background of to privacy? Of course, privacy is also a law, but what made you do this pivot? What did you see, or what was the driver behind this?
Probably the driving force behind my pivot to privacy has been my longstanding interest in technology, gadgets, new means of computing and communicating. And then the primary immediate driver of my switch to privacy was the pandemic, because my own career as a sole practice attorney was largely dependent on networking, being out with people, hosting meetings, attending meetings, conferences, seminars. And with the pandemic, I had a lot of time on my hands, a lot of extra time. And one of the things I've really enjoyed about my career as an attorney is the breadth of activities that I can get involved in. So through the course of my practice, I've been involved in a lot of different things, from commercial representation, including contracts and corporate formalities, to personal representation, estate planning, which is very privacy oriented, consumer law. So there's many different areas of the law that a sole practitioner can be effective in. And so I've always had the ability to zig and zag. And what drew me to privacy was, with the pandemic and having a lot of time on my hands, I developed a fascination for the privacy implications of all the latest technologies that are at my disposal. Everything from social media to artificial intelligence, the computer programs that we use to communicate, to research. And I became very much aware of some of the intricate implications of the privacy implications of these things, primarily because of the New York Times series of articles on privacy. That was what really drew my attention to the field. And then through that, I found my way to Sasha Zuboff's terrific book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And that's what really drew me into the rabbit hole, that 500-page book, which I absolutely could not put down. And at the end, her final message was, be part of the resistance. Right. And so I took that to heart, and I decided to dive headfirst into privacy. That was back in February or March, and it's been nonstop ever since.
Good. So how would you put GDPR in one word just to kick off the conversation?
GDPR, I think, has been an amazing catalyst for privacy advocates across the world to bring to front and center some of these implications that have been lingering in the background for a long time. Now, all of a sudden, we've got a major regulatory scheme that operates on an international basis and is having some, it's the first international, you know, regimen to have an impact on a lot of these technologies and how they impact our way of life. So I would categorize GDPR as a catalyst if I had to pick one word to describe it.
That's very interesting. And it is indeed a catalyst, because if you look at it 3 or 4 years ago, nobody was talking about privacy. And now, even in a pandemic, when people have to give their data to a restaurant or something, and they're saying, oh, where is my privacy?
And it's just because of this one law, one regulation.
I think that's true. And also because of this major impetus from the European theater, we now are seeing a global groundswell of support for privacy laws all over the world. Brazil, you know, it recently enacted its LGPD. And then we've even China is getting in on the bandwagon with the recent release of its laws. And now, of course, most pertinent to my situation, the California privacy law, which was just passed by the voters of California. And in terms of size, economic impact, and social impact, the California privacy law is sure to be another catalyst for probably a national privacy legislation here in the United States, or at the very least, a catalyst for more states to say we need to follow this path and protect our citizens' right to privacy as they've done in California. So all of this, I think, was started primarily by GDPR back when it was passed in 2018. And of course, it took a few years to get going. And same thing with the California privacy legislation that was just passed. It's 2 years out now from becoming, you know, fully implemented with the new revisions. So it's really exciting. It's an exciting time to be a part of this field and to try to watch the regulatory mechanisms catch up with the technology that's being used to you know, operate in our modern society.
Yeah, and I think very soon we will also have the e-privacy regulation in EU, and that will also shift the way things are done in terms of communication between people and the communication happening from companies. But it remains to be seen what will be the final shape or shape of the regulation as it comes along.
It Absolutely.
Yeah. So you have been a lawyer, and when I talk to a lot of other lawyers who are DPOs, there's a consistent debate generally around technical skills, saying I'm not a technologist. And it's fascinating to see that when I talk to technologists who are DPOs, they say I don't know the law. And when I talk to the lawyers, then they say I need to know the technology. And then I see the career aspirants, and they're like, I'm a lawyer, should I know technology? I'm a technologist, should I know law? And in my opinion, just to give you my perspective, you need to know everything, but you need to, rather than know everything, you need to understand and challenge, have the capability to grasp what the other person is saying, what the other person is needing, and having a basic understanding. But you don't need to be an expert in each and everything. It's like, even as a lawyer or as a CEO, you advise multiple people, but you don't know their business inside out. You ask the relevant question, get the insights, and then advise them. But what's your view, especially being a lawyer and now pivoting to privacy? Do you see the need for technical skills or even other skills? I mean, because privacy needs a lot of other competencies. The technical one gets highlighted a bit more than the other ones.
I think that what you're characterizing, Punit, is the breadth and depth of expertise that's necessary across the board in the entire field of privacy. And right. I don't think any one person could hope to bring to the table that, you know, all-encompassing breadth and depth. And if one proclaims to do so, I would be very wary of that proclamation. I think, especially with the case of lawyers, the hardest part for any lawyer to do is to say, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be in our vocabulary. We don't want it to be in our vocabulary because people expect us to be an expert. For better or for worse, they expect us to be an authoritative voice, not recognizing that our particular skills may be quite limited to the, you know, particular specialty that we fall under. There are plenty of attorneys who focus on intellectual property, copyright, tax, and they may not necessarily know the first thing about privacy. And so it's important to recognize that we all bring our own unique set, our own unique combination of experiences and skills to the table. And so I don't think it's appropriate to set a baseline to say you must have these particular things, because it really depends on what the individual brings to the table, the unique perspective, the unique background. It certainly doesn't hurt to have a tech background, and that's certainly been one of my motivating features, because I'm a techie and I just can't get enough of the latest technology. And when I myself arrived to the privacy theater, as I call it, I come to it from the perspective of somebody who embraces and loves technology. One of my favorite presentations to offer is the top 10 privacy invading technologies. What are my favorite privacy invading technologies in terms of what they do for society, in terms of the benefits that we probably could not live without, the life-saving technology. And so for me, at least, my technological background forms an integral part of who I am. Mm-hmm. But getting back to your specific question, what if my particular specialty was, constitutional policy? That's every bit as valuable, has nothing necessarily to do with tech, but the mindset, the critical thinking skills that that particular specialist will bring to the table are every bit as necessary as those of somebody with a technical background. So whatever people bring to the table, the most important thing is their energy, their enthusiasm, and their passion for having an impact on the privacy implications of what they're trying to accomplish.
Exactly. And I think sometimes people have this impression, at least outside in, thinking that there's a DPO and he knows inside out and everything. Well, it depends, because there are some people who specialize in data processing agreements, which is a field in itself. Some specialize in the DPIA and some specialize in other things. And while there are the generalists who can oversee everything else, but then they don't, they won't be comfortable doing everything else so deeply. So it really depends what you bring to the table.
Absolutely. And I think the most critical skill of any DPO could bring to the table is the ability to find the answers. Not the ability to know all the answers, but to know where to reach out to the experts that have the relevant experience for the matter at hand. And the ability to make those connections, find those resources, is a great way to protect the enterprise from hidden traps that are related to privacy or any other kind of regulation.
I fully agree. I think it's ability to find answers and ability to provide advice, because you don't need to decide, but you need to be able to weigh in and say, these are your options, these are the risks, these are the consequences, make a choice. And if you can put in a succinct, clear language, then you've done your job without even getting into their domain.
Absolutely. And boy, is it exciting in the privacy world.
Indeed, that is. And that leads to the other question also, because there seems to be a fascination with certifications. Because when you open LinkedIn or any other media these days, I'm certified. And certifications are relevant because they do prove a point that you know something or you've cleared something. But in my opinion, they would get you maybe a little bit filtered your CV or get you to the interview table. But beyond it, then it comes to your real skills. So what's your view on the purpose of these certifications? Because I see that as you pivoted, you have also gone for these certifications and you managed to do them, all of them almost.
Of course. And as a preface to my comments, I will highlight the fact that I am the king of certifications in terms of the IAPP. That was my introduction to privacy, was finding the IAPP website and learning that they offer this certification paradigm, not only just for the United States, but for Europe, for Canada, for Asia, for management, for technology. And I soon learned that these were all available to the dedicated learner who wanted to dive in and gain the skills that they are suggesting are appropriate for these types of roles. And so I think that the certifications provide an excellent vehicle for any individual to demonstrate knowledge, dedication, intense interest and passion in the field. Of course, those that pursue a certification, by their very nature of pursuing that certification, show that they're interested and that they want to learn. But one of the most interesting things that many people don't really realize about especially the IAPP certifications, if you look at the fine print, you'll see that those certifications qualify you with the minimal requirements necessary to serve a role in the field. And it's not that exact language, but it's certainly there to that effect that, hey, you get this certificate and you've demonstrated that you've got the minimum knowledge necessary, not the maximum. And indeed. So you have to take it for what it is. I call it a conversation starter. I think you mentioned it might get you an interview. It might get you a foot in the door because a potential employer recognizes that you've demonstrated this interest. But it really is up to the individual to bring more than a piece of paper, bring more than a certification. You've got to demonstrate your ability to act in the theater of privacy. And oftentimes we bring the skills that we have in our past along with us, whether those are legal, analytical, or technological skills. There's a role for everybody. And the certification process simply serves as a point of contact, a point of reference to say, hey, I'm here in the game and I'd like to participate.
Indeed. And I think people tend to overestimate the value of certifications because most job descriptions would say strongly preferred or preferred, not never saying mandatorily required. They prefer that you have a certification because that gives them a confidence that you know a bit. But the real test is in the interview when they're asking you questions, and even the bigger test is when you're on the job and you're facing real life situations.
Absolutely.
And then these certifications, in my opinion, do not prepare you for facing those real life situations because that's a different ball game.
It's not until you really get on the job and learn the inner workings of a privacy office, if that's where you find yourself, or in an entrepreneurial setting where you're setting up a new enterprise. On the job learning is so critically important. And I think that's why it's important to find your, if you're new to privacy, it's important to find yourself in a home where there's experts around you. And that's been kind of the pinnacle of my own career, is surrounding myself with people who are smarter than I. I don't like to be the smartest person in the room. If I am, maybe something's wrong because I want to stretch myself. I want to extend my capabilities. And I can only do that by surrounding myself with people of different, you know, specialties, skills, and experiences. And I think that's a critical point for, you know, newcomers, not only in privacy, but in any field.
Right. And I think you need to surround yourself with a network. I call it a DPO network, a privacy network, or whatever, or a community in which like-minded people get together, share their challenges, share their problems, and then collectively you find solutions and learn from each other. Because the fascinating thing about this field is, for one problem, there can be 10 answers and all 10 can be correct.
Absolutely. One of the nice things that, if there is any nice thing that the pandemic has brought to us in the year 2020, is our ability to reach out, to network, and to participate in many different avenues across the globe. And this has been one of the defining features of my entry into privacy, is that I find my way onto online seminars on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. I don't have enough hours in the day to attend them all, but everything from Daniel Solov's Privacy and Security Academy to the IAPP sessions, which are now online. You know, there's just all kinds of government agencies. The local knowledge nets has been a really interesting thing for me to pop into local chapters of the IAPP. I've done so in Sydney, Australia, in Brussels, up in Amsterdam. It's just kind of fun. And it's a variety of context to drop in and see what people are doing across the world in terms of privacy. And one of the defining features that I've found is how open and welcoming people are to you when you drop in and say, hey, I'm here from Chicago. It's really been a godsend. And I think it's important to focus on positive, optimistic aspects of any situation. And that's why I raise that as one of the positive things that the pandemic has done for us.
Of course, I think there are a lot of positive things in every situation, and pandemic is no different. But if we go there, then it'll become a philosophical discussion and we need another podcast for that.
There you go.
Yeah, but coming back to the certification versus knowledge versus job. So if you were hiring somebody, who would you hire? Would you hire somebody with a certification or knowledge? If you have two people, one well-certified and one well-knowledgeable without certification. So who would you go for and what would be your thought process? I mean, it doesn't have to be either or, but what's your thought process in hiring somebody?
I would prefer that individual with the knowledge base over the certification. I think if somebody can demonstrate a working expert knowledge of the field, that's probably more important than a piece of paper. But one thing I would like to emphasize is how difficult a hiring process can be in today's day and age, because you have thousands of people applying for work. And it's largely done electronically and through automatic processing, which is, of course, one of the issues in privacy that we address. But the automatic processing implications of the job search are just awful. It's probably the least effective method of choosing an adequate and excellent employee. by having a computer screen resumes looking for certifications. And sadly, that's a lot of the way that it defaults to these days. It's pretty rare that you can identify somebody without the appropriate initials and letters on their resume, because those people don't get passed through the automatic processing. No. And so my advice to people, whether you're on the hiring side or whether you're an applicant looking for a role, probably the best thing that either one of these two people can do to come together is to make every attempt possible at personal interactive networking. That's shaking of hands, smiling, interpersonal interactions, whether it's online or off, because that's really the true way that you can gauge someone's personality, their personal skills. That's the true way that you can gauge their ability to communicate effectively on a particular subject, the face-to-face interaction. You're not going to get that from a resume. You're not going to get that from a LinkedIn profile. You're not going to get that from an IAPP certification. So truly, I think that the most effective way to bring employer and employee together is, again, through personal networking. And I just wish there were more effective ways of doing that in today's society.
Sure. And continuing with our theme on certifications, I know you also launched your podcast recently, and you talked about it in your first episode, but give us a slight preview into how was your experience when you did these exams, and was it a test of knowledge or was it a test of nerves? Was it what kind of pressure was there, and how much of and what can somebody learn from it in terms of somebody who's appearing in an exam or a certification exam in coming days, weeks?
I'm so glad you asked about that, because it's something I have a lot of experience with, having recently passed each and every one of these certifications. And I think that each of the points you raise is relevant to the experience. But one thing before I forget is, I've heard in my travels virtually across the globe, as I talk about the certification process, many people tell me it's a test of your English language skills, which I find to be completely inappropriate and odd. It's sad that these exams are not offered in French, that they're not offered in Dutch or German. I think that an interesting project would be to translate the exam experience into more native languages, so that people aren't struggling just with their command of English, because a subtle nuance in a question or in an answer can mean the difference between a passing and failing scores. So sometimes it is a test of your English language knowledge. But it is also a very excellent test of your general knowledge of the subject matter. And most of the certifications are very clear. They're crystal clear in terms of the subject matter that's going to be tested on the exam. They oftentimes will have a body of knowledge. They'll have an exam blueprint, and they will tell you how many questions are going to be on a particular subject matter. And that's critical to anybody's success as they prepare for these exams, because you have the exam blueprint right in front of you. You know what's going to be on that test. And if you immerse yourself in that material for a sufficient period of time, if you prepare properly, you can walk in there with a great deal of confidence. And that's the second critical piece that's necessary to pass any of these certifications, is confidence, because this is a confidence game. And I mean that in a very positive sense of the word. It's a confidence game in that you need to show up with a degree of confidence that you know this material, and you're not going to let that computer exam tell you otherwise. And it's a game of nerves. I can remember distinctly my first test experience was in person. I went to one of these testing centers where they are testing a variety of people on everything from financial regulations to insurance to privacy to cosmetology. And you're in a room with 50 people. You're each sitting at your own little cubicle, and you can hear everybody typing away on their keyboards. And it's the most nerve-wracking experience. And you know that you're under a lot of pressure to pass this test. And that's the worst experience ever. And the first one, I was like a deer in headlights, staring at that computer, and the questions did not seem to match the material that I learned. How could this possibly be? And so I think it was more the fear factor than anything else. And so I was able to calm down, put that fear aside, and focus on one question at a time, and use some of my internal intuition, because I knew this material and I was not going to let the computer tell me otherwise. I studied long, I studied hard, and the first few questions I just guessed at. Well, I guess I guessed properly because my confidence level began to build. Mm-hmm. I gained more confidence with each click of the button, and I still had a lot of rough spots because that's a long exam. It takes like 2.5 hours to plow through this, and at about the halfway mark, you're really spent. I mean, if you're like me, you're exhausted and you just want to end it. Like, oh, I must have failed this. I just got to push the button and go home. Well, I found the mental energy to carry myself through this 2.5 hours. I think I even had 10 minutes to spare where I went back and, you know, reviewed a few questions, but I just didn't have the energy for much retroactive review. So let me tell you about the best part of the whole exam experience. You're done. You've done your best. You push that button on the computer and you wait like an endless 3 seconds until the words pass show up on the computer screen. And then it's like, oh, this overwhelming feeling of joy and relief. So it's an interesting experience, but it does draw upon every ounce of energy you've got in terms of confidence, in terms of knowledge, and just your mental stamina. So I think it's really important to do it at a time when you're, you know, fresh and at your best, whether you're a morning person or a midnight person. So
absolutely.
That was my first experience at the exam. And then the remainder of them I was able to take at home using the online monitoring. And that's another positive impact of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. It allowed organizations to get creative in how to offer the same testing opportunities. And one of my favorite things to say about the privacy exams is that in order to pass a privacy exam virtually, you need to give up a little bit of your privacy. The computer proctor, there are proctors that take control of your computer. They take control of your webcam. They take control of your microphone, and they watch you, and they listen to you. And a funny story for me, I had a tendency to take the exam and put my hands on my chin because I was tired. And so I would put my hands over my face and my elbows on the desk as I'm thinking about a question. And I would get this big pop-up message from the proctor. Dear Mr. Basore, please remove your hands from your face. We want to make sure you're not talking to somebody. So that was the kind of control that they had. And I found that to be quite invasive because obviously I wasn't doing anything. I was all alone in my surroundings and it was quiet. But just the philosophical point that you must give away a little bit of your privacy in order to pass a privacy exam was quite poignant for me.
No. And I think there's also this test of nerves, as you say, or the pressure, because when you're doing it, you know these are the 5 steps, especially in the CIPM exam. You know these are the 5 steps or 6 steps in this or 6 stages, and you remember them. But when you go to the exam, you have those 5 stages 5 times or 4 times in a question, and one word is changing. And then you're like, oh, what was this? What was this R? Was it respond? Was it response? And it's just that little thing. And so it tests you on that, because when I did it about 3.5 years ago. But at that time, the CIPP, I went in and I was confident I'll go through. But the CIPM, because of these questions, which have slight nuances and they test your nerves, test your, and also confuse you a bit with so much of information overload, because it's very similar answers. You need to eliminate, then you're left with 2 and you need to pick and choose each and every word you need to match. And if you're one of those, sometimes you tend to be overconfident saying, I know these are the 3 keywords, but in between the wrong keyword is inserted. And they are energy sapping. And so at the end of CIPM, I was exactly like you. I don't know what will happen. So let me press the button. I had about 30 minutes, maybe 40 minutes extra. But I said, let me go because I can't take that nerve-wracking experience. And what I would do is if I review, I might change my initial response to those questions.
Absolutely. And you passed, able to set aside the pressure that you were experiencing during that testing experience. And you passed because you were well prepared for that exam. And I think that's critical, is the advanced preparation. You're not going to pass these tests if you take them a week after you decide to take it. You've got to allow time to review the material, to study the material, to embrace the material, and to think about it over and over again. Not only by reading the suggested textbook, but also by finding alternative resources to help you along this path, whether it's guided study or whether it's listening to seminars or reading books, white papers. There's all sorts of resources that are available both on the internet and off. And I think it's critical for people to have sufficient preparation to say, you know what, I'm an expert on this. Not only am I going to pass, but I'm going to succeed beyond my wildest dreams. And if you can have that confidence when you go into the testing experience, I think that's really going to help you.
Yeah, and I think if I may add, you also need to know which certification you are doing and choose those kind of things. So if, because I was talking to one of my clients and the person wanted to do CIPP, but when I spoke to the person, she was telling me that I'm learning about pseudonymization. And I said, why? She said, the topic fascinates me. And I said, but you want to clear your CIPP. You need to know what pseudonymization is, but what are the types, how it works, what is the technology behind? That's for the CIPT. So don't mix the two. Get your exam done and then work on your excitement, fascination, and all those interests. Because if so, maybe you can share your experience around these three exams, the professional, the manager, and the technologist. They have a purpose and they have a meaning objective behind them. Because yes, it's all about privacy. Yes, it's about the same law, generally GDPR and around it. But the question that gets asked in each one of them is from a different standpoint and a different perspective. Would you like be able to guide people on that perspective?
Absolutely, because as a techie, as an advocate of technology, somebody who loves gadgets and the latest, greatest inventions, my natural inclination, I probably should have taken the CIPT exam first, but I did not. I took the CIPP US. Because I felt that was more valuable to my own career. But I had that CIPT in the back of my mind, and I found that those were very interesting things to study. And for me, the study of privacy has been an endless series of rabbit holes. And it's really critical that you explore some of those rabbit holes. It's important to go down those routes, even if they're not on the test, because it generates interest, it generates passion, and you can probably find a connection between a particular technology and a particular conceptual framework that's necessary for the CIPM or the CIPP. So there are connections that can be made. And if you are exercising your intellectual capacity to bridge the gap between the two, that can be every bit as valuable. But you do need to recognize that there are endless rabbit holes. And if you find yourself studying concepts of quantum computing, encryption, and blockchain while you're studying for the CIPP exam, that's not necessarily the best use of your time, unless that's what wakes you up and re-energizes you for another 3 hours of studying of regulations. So there's a part for everybody.
Yeah. And I think I call it the focus principle. So if you're doing CIPP, study the law. Look at it from a lawyer's perspective or advisory perspective. If you're doing the manager CIPM, look at it from a manager's perspective. How would you manage things? And if you're doing technologist, look at the intersection and interplay of technologies and focus on that. Focus on it for 4 weeks, 6 weeks. Study from that perspective. Do the exam, and then you can do all the interests and hobbies on the side afterwards. So then you have enough opportunity. Otherwise, what will happen is you'll get distracted from your main objective, which is a certification.
Yes, the thing I found most relevant to my own studying for these exams was to take make a habit and take time to study each day. I set aside 2 hours each and every day, and that was easy for me because I'm an early bird. I wake up at the crack of dawn. So I'm up at 4 a.m. when the rest of the world is still sleeping, and I just really enjoy watching the darkness turn to twilight, turn to the rising sun, and that's when I'm at my freshest with a cup of coffee and a guidebook in front of me, and consistently, each and every day, I mean, sure, I missed a couple. I decided to sleep in until 6, but as a general rule, I followed the same pattern of studying for about 30, 40 days for each of these exams. And I just made it a point that that was going to be the focus of my intellectual excess for that period of time. Because if you've got so many different things on your mind, if you're trying to learn to play the piano and learn the French language and pass a CIPP exam all at the same time, not too many people have the intellectual capacity to master those divergent interests. So I think it's critical to find a point of time for yourself that works for you to get the job done and to allow it to run its course. Whether it takes you 30 days or 60, you really need to be comfortable that you've built the expertise. And in retrospect, it's easy to look back and say, you know exactly what's going to be on these exams. Look at the blueprint. Look at the body of knowledge. It's not rocket science. If there's a subject that is not on those two documents, it's not going to be on the test.
Yeah.
So it just seems so easy in retrospect. But boy, at the time, it was nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and I think I appreciate that IAPP is so transparent that they put it, this topic has these many questions, minimum, maximum. So you have all the information. And it's about focusing and repeating on a day-on-day basis, because typically people ask me, like, how many hours should I study? Well, that depends on you, because somebody is maybe really blessed at grasping concepts and maybe has been working in privacy for 3 years, 2 years, and they don't even need to study. They will just go in and pass CIPPE, maybe not for the CIPM or CIPT. But somebody else who may need repetition and may have challenges in terms of doing it consistently for 30 or 40 days, then that's a different ballgame. There's no one-size-fits-all solution, because some need training, some don't need training, some need books, some need to read, some need to listen. So there are different kinds of people.
Absolutely. There's resources for everyone out there.
Yes, and you need to know what resource you need and what is your strength, and you play according to that. But I won't recommend them to get up at 4 o'clock unless it's natural for them. But I will certainly recommend that doing something every day, if you can do 2 hours a day, very good. But if not, make sure you do at least 15 to 30 minutes a day so that the rhythm stays and you're staying connected. Because if you come back after 1 week, the rhythm is lost. And your brain is trying to recap, reconnect with what it was. And you're not getting the synergies which you need to have to pass through an exam.
Absolutely. We all have our unique circumstances. And I think whatever the circumstances are, it's possible to develop that routine and to find the time and space necessary to master this material.
Right. So if there's somebody who wants to get into privacy, how would you recommend them to start?
I think by becoming involved in the industry in terms of the IAPP. I'm one of the biggest fans of that as an interest group that magnifies the message, that promotes the message. I think there's a wealth of resources available through the IAPP to give somebody a great idea of where they want to target. Because you probably should target yourself, whether you're interested in health privacy or intellectual matters such as artificial intelligence, cryptography. You do have to narrow down. You can't just say you're interested in privacy. That's too broad of a topic. And I think for someone who's interested in that, needs to spend some time developing their passion into more specificity so that they know what they want to do. And then my advice is to reach out and connect with people on the internet who have the expertise. LinkedIn is an amazing tool, and people are so welcoming and engaging. You can send someone a message and say, hey, I listened to you on this particular podcast, or I read your article in the Privacy Officer magazine. People love to be recognized, especially the experts. They love to be recognized, and they love to help others get entry to the field. So my advice for people is don't be bashful. Reach out, say hello to people. Don't be afraid to tell them you're new. Just be a presence and be a thoughtful presence. I'm not saying, be a nuisance. Just get out there and try to contribute. If you've got something to write, if you review a lot of the articles that are online, there's so many subjects that one could contribute to. And you don't need to write a thesis about these things. You could simply, write a clarifying article, point out something that struck home to you. Be thoughtful. Be persistent and seek to have an impact. And I think those that follow those steps will certainly find their way in privacy and be able to contribute.
Right. And I think I would add one more thing, saying be yourself. Because if you're trying to be like, I have to be like that or this or then it doesn't work. Be yourself, learn it, and then explore what you can do with it.
Absolutely. And I think if you can find a passion of yours that's already existing and somehow relate it to the privacy world, you can develop a theme, you can develop a brand for yourself. And so that's something that I've done. Many people know that I happen to be a sailor, and that accounts for my beautiful background on this video call of Bermuda in my background, which is not where I am today. But I'm a sailor. I love the paradigm of the safe harbor. I love the paradigm of guiding the ships at sea to follow the correct path. I've created a podcast of myself called Navigating Privacy. I have an enterprise, a consulting enterprise called Navigating Privacy. And that's just the theme song that I've been able to bring in and to advocate different aspects of the field that are important to me, while at the same time establishing a personal brand that's also reflective of some of my adventuresome spirit, my teamwork spirit. And so that's a specific example of how someone can use their existing activities to brand themselves in the privacy field and to find a focus of their effort. And I think that can be certainly helpful when looking for a home in the field.
Absolutely. So to round it up, what would be your one final message to people who are kind of starting their journey or in selection of a certification or making choices around how do they go about certification? So one final message to wrap things up.
I think a great start is, again, I'm going back to the IAPP as the world-renowned interest group on privacy. Their general certification of CIPP US or the European or the Canadian, you know, wherever you happen to be, wherever you see yourself in the next 5 or 10 years, that's a great entry level point of contact to say that you've done this certification. It allows you to connect with thousands of other people across the globe who have followed this similar path, and it gives you a common bond to connect with them. So that would be my advice, is to go for that kind of a certification as your way of joining the community and actually participating.
Yeah, and I think I would emphasize between quotes the two, one thing you said, that is keep a long-term perspective and see where you are 10 years from now. Don't jump on saying, it's hot, it looks like lucrative, okay, it's pandemic, maybe I need to find a job, let me do privacy. Don't look at it that like that, look at it from a long-term perspective, saying, where do I see myself 10 years? And then work backwards. And if this fits in, that's good. If it doesn't, then also it is good.
Absolutely. But don't be afraid to jump in. If you find that this is your passion, go jump in with both feet, not just one toe. Don't dip your toe into privacy. Immerse your entire self into it. Absolutely.
Go all out. And so, Thomas, if somebody wants to contact you, yes, your podcast, Navigating Privacy, is one option. But how do they find you? Where do they contact you?
People can reach out to me on LinkedIn. My name is Thomas Besore. That's B-E-S-O-R-E. And so my profile is out there available on LinkedIn. You can also reach me by email. I'm thomas@besore.com. And then, of course, I've got all kinds of different ways to communicate, all the modern technology platforms, whether it's Skype or Zoom or WhatsApp or Telegram or Signal. Wow. there's so many ways to reach out to people. And if you're listening to this and you're looking for a little motivation, a little ratification of your ideas about getting into privacy, I'm happy to speak with you personally and directly. So please don't be bashful. I just wish that there were more professionals that were so welcoming and open to bring new people in, because it truly is a village. And to those of us that are passionate about this, it's great to have the camaraderie of others that share this type of enthusiasm. So please welcome anybody to reach out and chat with me about it.
That's really nice of you, Thomas. And I can assure you that most privacy people are very generous and very open to talk. The only thing is sometimes people are not reaching out to them. But anyhow, it is wonderful to have you have a great conversation around privacy careers and certifications. And thank you so much for being here.
Again, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure. I love talking about these subjects.
That was certain.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you like this effort. Please do click like, comment, and share. It is okay if you did not like it. Please still do make a comment and share with us what we can improve. If you have suggestions, ideas for guests, or you want to have your question answered, please email me. My email is info@punitbhatia.com. You can also share this with others, and if you do so while tagging me in, I will personally thank and acknowledge your contribution in coming episodes. Thanks once more, and look forward to seeing you back. Till then, stay safe, stay blessed, and stay happy.